So this is, everything is quite new. This is new. The last time I spoke with a microphone was almost 24 years ago. It was the size of a pineapple in front of me. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredibly wonderful for me to have sat with you. This is the second non-residential retreat that I sat here at IMC, and it's quite an experience.
Is the speaker loud enough? People hear okay, or should we?
Am I loud enough? Maybe. I also have a cold, so everything, as I said, is very different. Please let me know if I'm not loud enough. And what I have to say sometimes is so delicate, it's kind of harder coming out. So this time I got a chance to do a little bit of service. It was really much far, far, far sweeter than I thought it would be. I was going willing to do it because Gil asked, and for many years now I have been a receiver of a lot of kindness from IMC. So I was delighted to do it, but didn't realize that the process itself I was going to enjoy as much as I did, or I have. Anytime I come and sit at IMC, just have a feeling of this incredible support around me. And really the feeling that absolutely anything that I feel or experience or wish to speak about or is okay, it's fine. You know, there are not that many places in this world where that is true. And so even though I have not spoken in public now for many years, it feels fine because anything that happens is okay, and that's what's happening. That's truly is an incredible feeling. Well, when Gil first told me that I would also have to speak and I would have to ring the bell and be very mindful, out of a number of feelings, among them definitely was a sense of, ooh, great, now I finally get noticed. You know? So I went home and told my husband, and my husband is very funny, and he said, yes, some power finally. And so I was quite delighted until I remembered what my mother said to me about her process of choosing a class monitor. My mother was a high school science and math teacher in India for many years, and she said, you know, the good ones, the good teachers, the experienced teachers, know to wait a couple of weeks before choosing a class monitor. Now, I don't know if you have that here, but in India, the class monitor sort of interfaces with the teacher and is also sort of responsible for minor level or discipline in the classroom and distributing, you know, handouts and collecting homework and all that. So she says, you know, the new ones think of something to be gotten over with, and on the first day choose a class monitor. She said, but the experienced one wait for a couple of weeks and choose the one that is the biggest troublemaker. Because once you put the biggest troublemaker to be the class monitor, you have eliminated your biggest troublemaker. So, I don't know, maybe Gil got rid of his biggest troublemaker during this particular retreat. So I have been coming to IMC for 7 years now. So started coming here 7 years ago when we were still in Palo Alto. And I brought my mom there for the first time. I came with my mom. I came so that I could bring my mom because I had my brother and I had just been to India. My father had passed away and had brought my mom here with us, there being no other immediate relative in India for her. And she was just devastated. She was devastated. She had looked after my father through his year and a half of slowly failing health due to prostate cancer alone, and done everything she possibly could for him. So she was emotionally and physically exhausted, and she had lost her best friend of 53 years. So having done some meditation myself, I thought that might be something that would be useful for her. And I heard that Shaila Tramovich was, I think, doing her first workshop probably on loving kindness. So I took my mom there. Well, it turned out that it wasn't quite the right thing for my mom at that particular time, and she found another practice, and she dropped out, but I stayed. So as you can tell from my accent and my shawls, and you know, I wasn't brought up here. I was brought up in India, in Bombay, in a nuclear family, my brother and my mother, father, brother and I. And as nuclear families get in India, they're not that nuclear because you have all these roots, you know. It's like, so I feel like the nuclear family in America is like an oak, and then, you know, there's another oak somewhere farther down, and there is communication, you know, when there's wind or whatever, and then the seeds mingle. But in India, it's like mint, you know. It's like all these roots under it. And you never know when a new one is going to sprout and somebody's going to adapt somebody in their family. So I have a large joint family, extended family. I have 26 cousins. So I grew up surrounded by absolutely wonderful people and having a lot of companions. Our household wasn't particularly religious. We are cultural Hindus. We had no idol in the house. There were no religious ceremony performed, no puja. It was a very deliberate decision on the part of my father and mother, who had seen a lot of harm that religion can do. They had seen blind faith leading to rejection of useful medical treatments. They had seen religious fundamentalism leading to sectarian violence, especially between Hindus and Muslims in India. So my father and my mother were both strong rationalists, and my father was sort of like a rationalist humanist, and he was a socialist by his political leanings. But it was a Brahminical household in the best sense of the term. Brahmins in India have traditionally been the priestly and the teacher class. You know, they traditionally taught scriptures, and then with the sort of modern ideas, they also taught other subjects. So they were the teacher and the priestly class, and they held themselves to a higher standard than most people did. So they were moderate in their living, simple in their living, moderate in their speech, and soft and deliberate in their speech, not to hurt anyone with your speech, not to utter falsehood, not to steal, not to harm, to be generous, to be kind. These were all the sort of, you know, unspoken precepts, and they're very strongly held in my family. And I sometimes talked about that a little bit here and elsewhere. And I think the reaction from people has always been, oh, you poor thing, to have such an onus of have a sort of higher expectation when you're young. And I wasn't able to explain it. I think I want to clarify this time is that even though there was really this very, very strong moral grounding and expectation, the household was just always joyous, filled with joy and laughter and music and friends and relatives dropping in and party, you know, and repartee and jokes. And so I have this image of a mango crate. You know, every Indian household in summer gets a mango crate with, you know, rows of mangoes in it. So it's like a wooden crate, and you have rows of unripe mangoes. And there's hay in between the rows, and then there are usually three rows on top. And, you know, and it used to be under this, kept under this iron bed on which I used to sleep, take my afternoon siesta in summer. And you know, you couldn't just, like, you know, buy this crate, put it under the bed, and then 2 weeks later take it out and enjoy the mangoes. You know, you had to look after it. So, you know, each mango was wrapped up in tissue, and then you had to sort of look at every morning. You had to take out the hay and take out the mangoes and inspect them, and if those were beginning to ripen, bring them to the top, and those were not, put them down and just turn them a little bit. You know, like the, you know, the winemakers do. And if there's any one that was going bad, then you had to take it out so it wouldn't, you know, the rest of the mangoes wouldn't rot. And so every morning you had to sort of, you know, delicately take care of your mangoes. But it was itself a beautiful task, because it was this beautiful, round, big mangoes that you had to, you know, gently turn, and the smell of hay and, you know, all that. And you put the hay back gently and you push the crate in. And so the whole ritual was, you know, very beautiful and very attentively done. And so if you took care of all that, then you have, I had this memory of incredible smell of these mangoes. The mangoes from India you don't get here. Incredible smell of this Alfonso mango just, you know, wafting up from the mattresses, giving me quite a afternoon siesta. So that's how it was. You took care of your, you know, your ethical life, you know, carefully, gently, lovingly, and then you just got to enjoy life, because then you didn't have to worry about it. But I was encouraged, in spite of being a daughter, I was very much encouraged to pursue higher education, and I came to this country to do exactly that and have a little adventure. And idea was that I would come here, do a master's, and go back. And my that time fiancé came here quite reluctantly. Basically because I wanted to come, so he came as well. And then I ended up at Stanford, actually, and to do a PhD in linguistics, and he got a job in high tech and locally, and the idea was for me to finish my PhD and go back to India, take up a professorship, you know, a teaching position. But PhDs take a long time, and a lot of things changed, and we decided just to stay here. So we had been married since the time I talked about, and so we landed at Stanford. We were already recently married, and then towards the later years of my PhD, we had a baby. And so I finished my PhD and I had a baby, and I started looking for a job. You know, what's here in the biggest business is high tech. So I went looking around, and I got this reply from people, you know, you're clearly very bright and you probably do very well, but you don't have any particular training that we are looking for. So it was very painful to have gone through this really intensive training during my PhD, and really intellectually very challenging, to, you know, end up and not being able to find any work. It took me a couple of years, and some trainee decided I would try to become a technical writer, and that sort of made a cogent story between linguistics and writing, even though there isn't really any connection between the kind of linguistics I did to writing. But and I got my job. So I was starting really quite at the bottom, but I was very determined to make a success of myself. And right from the get-go, I was taking classes in programming, taking classes in databases. It was a database company, taking classes in editing and that sort of thing. And within my first 3 months of my joining my first job, which was really a little difficult for me to come by, I was in a car accident. I was hit from behind, and I had a classic whiplash. And from the moment the car hit, my neck was in a lot of pain, and the car was totaled. So I was 34 at that time, and until then my body had been, you know, pretty much doing what I asked it to do. I mean, something I just took for granted. And all of a sudden all that vanished pretty quickly. I didn't really take any rest. The doctors really didn't recommend that much rest or physical therapy for a long time, and the pain just didn't go away. And in fact, very soon I had RSI, repetitive stress injury, at work. I'm sure it was not unrelated to what happened to me. And within a matter of 6 months, I had pain in both my wrists, both my elbows, both my shoulders, my hips. I had tension headaches. And within a year, I was a complete mess. And through it all, you know, I was still a mother. I was still a devoted mother. I cooked, I cleaned, you know, I continued to take classes. I continued to take, you know, do my full-time job. And I would go to different therapists. I tried all sorts of therapies, different therapists to take care of my body. So I still wanted to be, you know, the independent woman. So I'm an independent woman. I can earn a living. I can look after myself. I can look after the house. I can look after my baby. And the therapist will look after my body. Obviously, that didn't work very well. You know, you understand that. I didn't at that time. I was very focused on my career. So, my husband said a few years later, he said, he made a really good observation. He said, you know, Smita, all of your personality traits that were your strengths before the accident became your weaknesses after, you know, being dedicated to my work and being a perfectionist and, you know, sort of ignoring my body and being very focused and all that sort of stuff. So it was one of these therapists that, you know, was the one that helped me most. It seemed really centered, you know, really calm. And I asked him one day, how come you're so calm all the time? Do you do meditation? And, you know, he said, yes. And he gave me a tape of, he said, you know, guided meditation, go do it. So I put it in my purse and forgot about it for 2-3 days. And it was a New Year's Eve, I believe 1996, New Year's Eve, for 1997, so last day of 1996. And my husband had taken up a job with a startup then, and he was really busy, and he also had to take up some slack at home because I was in so much pain. And so we were behind on a lot of things, and he decided that we should not only not go out to celebrate, but not even like watch a movie at home or something, pop popcorn, but he wanted to pay bills or do our finances or something like that, because that's the only time he had. And I was furious. I was absolutely furious, and I did not see his side of the story at all. And, you know, I had my own story going, you know, how you are no fun, and this is carrying it too far, and, you know, all that, whatever. And really, really believed my story, and I was furious when I went to bed. And I was still furious when I got up in the morning. And it was New Year's Day now, 1997, and I said to myself, this is New Year's Day. This is not how I would like to start my year. And then I remembered I had this tape with me that, so I went to the study, you know, closed the door, popped the tape in the tape recorder and sat, and it was a tape by Stephen Levine on, you know, kind of the kind of meditation we do. And it was like a 20-minute tape, and I did a 20-minute of meditation. I opened my eyes, I got up, and I realized that I had no more anger left. I mean, the anger had just vanished. And that to me was an incredible revelation, because never, never before had that happened, however much I wanted it, especially when I got angry with my child. You know, 2 or 3 year olds can really be exhausting, and I was in pain and push your buttons, and I would get angry and really, really not want to, really not want to, and really, but there was no way. It's as much as hard as an alcohol, it is for an alcoholic to give up drink, and that hard it was for me to not get angry. And this anger vanished. I could not believe it. I went and woke up my family. We went for a hike. We went out for lunch. We had the most wonderful New Year's Day we have ever had. So, from the very beginning, it was very clear this was something very special. But I was still a very busy woman, and I still had things to accomplish. And so I did, do it probably once a week or twice a week, and still to tape. So I bought a couple of other tapes, others by Stephen Levine and some by Jack Kornfield. And So about a month passed by, so I must have done meditation at most, say, 8 times like this to guided meditation. And suddenly I started noticing something else. I mean, it's true, every time I did meditation, I got out, my body was more relaxed, some of the pain had diminished and all that. But I noticed something strange. At work, you know, I'd been in the same group for about a year and a half. It was a very large group of people, and suddenly all these people, especially a lot of women, they, you know, in the technical writing group, there were women. Suddenly these women started coming to me, and you'd go out for walks or lunch or whatever, and they started telling me their deepest, darkest secrets. So same people, we had known each other for a long time, and all of a sudden one, and then second, and then third, and the fourth, and I realized that something in me must have changed for them to all of a sudden feel free to come and tell me whatever it was that they were telling me. And I tried to find the right word for it, and somehow the word gratitude comes out, even though it might seem a little strange, but that's what I felt. Very grateful that these women considered me a safe enough haven to come and share their difficulties with me. And I was very moved by that. And I'm very moved about it, and I talk about it even now. So I realized there was something a lot more than, you know, an antidote for bad emotions, and a lot more than an antidote for pain that was going on here. But I didn't really get into it, I didn't have time. Until, you know, I went to India and brought my mother here and took her to IMC, and then I started coming here. So I started meditating independently without a tape, you know, sometime in between about April. I did a course on, you know, the stress, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction course. So that taught me a little bit how to do meditation on my own. And then 6-8 months later, I started coming to IMC. So I learned loving kindness and with Gil, and then I learned inside meditation. And so for 7 years, it's been off and on a practice of mine, and mostly off and for many years because I still had a younger child and I was working for a while. And later on, I had to stop working because the pain was just all pervasive. But I was in so much pain that I was sleeping a lot. You know, I was just exhausted. And for years, it took me years of just, I was just sleep almost all day. So I didn't really have a lot of time to do this meditation. But what I did do, and I couldn't always come to the IMC programs, and you know, we didn't have many daytime programs at that time because we were in Palo Alto. We had evening times, and then evening times my child usually needed me quite a bit and did not want to, you know, make her unhappy and then go do my meditation. This did not seem like the right kind of thing to do. But whenever I did manage, I really realized there was something really, really far beyond anything I could define that was going on. I mean, there was a longing that arose in me sort of to go further in meditation. That longing was just so intense and almost physical, almost worse in a sense, or maybe as bad as when a, you know, a woman wants to have a child. It was really that intense a longing. I didn't know where that came from, you know. It's not something that was in my background. And then there were sort of sudden, you know, flashes of stuff that came up during meditation, and you say, what is that all about? I remember once, we were still in Palo Alto when Gil did a guided meditation, and he gave us 3 questions, and I'd forgotten the first 2 because it wasn't that significant for me. And the third question, the last question was, what is your question that brings you here? What is your spiritual question that brings you here? And I remember I was like, had my eyes closed, and I said, rolled my eyes even though they were closed and said, that's a little cliche, you know, whatever. So I was really, really very, almost mocking, very disrespectful. And I closed my eyes and whew, it's like my spine went zoom, and then out came this something in me said this, and it said you're not your mother's daughter and you're not your daughter's mother, then who are you? And I'm still trying to figure that one, you know. I said, where did that come from? It was a time of my life I was taking care of my mother a lot and, you know, involved a lot with my daughter, but there's clearly something beyond. So I learned to meditate before I came to IMC. At IMC I was introduced to the sort of larger Buddhist philosophical context for the first time. And I'm sure it's true for a lot of you here who were brought up in the 20th century, you know, and especially those of you in the Valley. The Buddhist philosophy is very appealing just because it is both complex and simple at the same time. And it takes a lot of conventional ideas and turns them on its ear. So the idea that you follow the precepts not as a protection for those who are around me, just for the protection of those who are around you, but for yourself, a protection for yourself, the idea that you protect yourself when you undertake the precept was just incredibly novel, and said, wow. And a whole bunch of sort of seemingly ironic and seemingly contradictory ideas that to find yourself, you have to realize that there is no self, even though I didn't know what that was. Wow. You know, the idea is a generous person is sort of by definition a rich person, because that is the person who has more than enough to give away. So this, oh cool, and gee whiz factor, you know, that is necessary for a lot of us to sort of first come and sit and, you know, do this, was definitely operative for me, because I had, you know, my work life was sort of dwindling and I had nothing, you know, complex or interesting to sort of chew on, and, you know, I was suddenly at home with a 70-year-old mother and a, you know, 6-7-year-old daughter, and woo, and all my life I had always been involved in sort of intellectual pursuits. So this practice and this philosophy definitely gave me something to. I could always still be researching. You know, I love research, so I could always, what bigger subject than your own mind, and to see what happens, you know, how you interact with people, what comes up for you, what judgments come up. Oh my God, that was a big revelation, is to notice how many judgments come and then number them, you know, 1, 2. So in that sense, I think this practice and this philosophy saved my life. I think I would have gone crazy without it. That's maybe not everybody's experience, and that's not why it was created, but that's how it is for me. I mean, if somebody had told me, you know, come sit here and say Om or do any other chanting, I don't think I would have. Even first time, I wouldn't have done it. So there is an intellectual appeal, and I do want to acknowledge it. It was very important for me. So it is still a big challenge, you know. It's still a big challenge to sit. It's still a big challenge to remember my intentions, to keep coming back to my intentions. But I was helped in a big way, first because IMC moved here and we had a number of daytime programs, and I could come for those, and I could come for the Wednesday half-day retreats, and then Gil has had the incredible Dharma working days on Fridays, and so I could combine very easily my family life and this without too much botheration or too much difficulty and interference. It's been very big for me. And my family recognizes how important it is for me, and they push me out, you know. When I first started sitting, within a few months, my daughter would say, come up to me and say, Mommy, have you done your meditation today? Because you are awfully, awfully angry. So please go do your meditation. So now she says, it's Monday, are you going to go to IMC? I said, do you need me? No, you go, you know it makes a difference. So she is now 13. Because the society at large, you know how it is, you all know it, society at large is telling you, you know, to be rich, to be thin, to be, you know, have success, to have your photo on the cover of X, Y, or Z, or this ultimate. And so it's nice to be able to come here once a week and hear that it's not so. And so reconnect to that, oh yes, this is all that's needed, this is all that's needed. And what I truly appreciate is the gift that I got of seeing how beautiful things are. I'm sure you have noticed that too. It's sort of, you know, the beauty being in the eye of the beholder. It's the same world, but I'm looking at it with different eyes. One day I was driving, just a few months after I started meditating, I was driving along, and for some reason, you know, there was like tall trees in Menlo Park, and the sun was such a way that I could see reflection of the trees in my, you know, windshield. And something about that image made me realize that, so this meditation practice is sort of putting a shield around me such that only the good stuff comes up and the bad stuff is left behind. And that is absolutely so incredibly true. Especially, you know, when I'm just done the sitting, I just brought the mindfulness presence. Everything around just is just incredible. This morning, you know, there was absolutely no milk in the house when I left the house, and my mom is there right now. So my husband was still sort of waking up. He puts in really late hours, so he was still sort of snoozing in bed. And I said, honey, I'm really sorry to ask you this, but can you get some milk? There isn't any milk. There is some time, but I just don't have the energy to do that today. And he, you know, he didn't even get from out from under the covers. And he said, but of course. And just the way he said it, I'm sure it was the way I asked, because I've been coming here for 4 days, you know. And my ears have been trained so I could really hear him. It just seemed like an ocean of love, just an ocean of, but of course. I was really, really moved by that. And sitting here among all of you and realizing that each one of you has, you know, left somebody behind to come here, you know, a spouse or child or parent or a cat or a dog or, you know, your friends on the internet or whatever, and then to be here and sort of realize that I'm sitting not just with this community but just that other community that also is, but of course, take the time, come here, because we appreciate the results. I was incredibly lucky. In spite of my difficulty in, you know, keeping regularity of practice, in spring of 2004 and 2005, my family gave me this incredible opportunity to go and sit for a month. In the spring of 2004, my in-laws were here and they took care of my daughter and, you know, did the cooking and whatever. So I could go, and this year it was my mother, you know, made sure the daughter got up in the time and had her lunch and came home and did her homework and all that happens for a whole month. And so I could go away, and I went to this incredible place that's in San Jose where Burmese monks come, are some of them are resident and some senior ones come from Burma every year to lead a retreat. And to have that, if any of you are hesitant about doing a long retreat, I really, really encourage you to do that, because hard as it is, it's really, there is no other way to really sort of cleanse and purify and really know who you are. And because now, after having done that, what I notice is that my daily practice still is almost as sporadic as before, But I do notice that if I get too far out in my thoughts or too far out in my actions, I do notice much more easily, and I can come back, and I just ask myself to come back. And to come back is more easy too. And you know, there I don't know the word for it, but on my first retreat, in a sense, I found grace. You know, I just entered the lunchroom and sitting and eating, and as I was eating, I realized that every time I put my spoon, I put it into my mouth and chewed, and every action, and then it lasted for almost a whole day. Any action I took was just so incredibly sweet. It's like if I turn my hand this way, as if I was a ballerina, you know, on a big stage in New York and doing the most incredible pirouette ever in this world. It just felt that fantastic. I just then realized I just really didn't need anything else. What else can you need if every time that you move, it's the most perfect, or every time you take a breath, it's the most perfect that can be? These kind of things are hard to come by. Maybe they do sometimes just by themselves, but to have that sort of realization, oh my goodness. And then you remember, you know, even that passes, it doesn't stay. At least it didn't stay for me. I wasn't that deep. Maybe it does for those who are, you know, reached the ultimate, but it was a glimpse, it passed. But you do remember that, you know. There's somewhere, there's a body has a memory, and somewhere the mind has a memory, and you sort of, you know, go too far off. You don't get the pleasure, but you sort of have that state of grace, and you say, where is the grace? You know, I sort of say, where is the grace? I can find it right here. I can find it right there. And I also realize, as I'm saying this, that you don't have to be a Buddhist. It's incredible, you know. I was asked to do this and give a talk, and nobody knows if I'm a Buddhist, if I converted, and I haven't. But now you know. But nobody cares. I find this is just so incredibly refreshing. And I've seen so many people in my life who are not Buddhists, who are not religious, who don't have a spiritual request, but spiritual quest, but are my teachers. And I take incredible inspiration from them. And those come in all sizes. I remember my daughter was 4 years old, and you know, these games kids play. So she was playing this game with me. She said, what would you do if you were given 3 wishes? What would you ask for? And you know, all my desires came up. And I said, oh, I would like to be well, I would like to not have pain, and with the second wish, I think I bought myself a big house. We kind of needed that. And the third wish, who knows, you know, something along the line. And I said, so how about you? So she looked at me and says, yeah, first wish, I would like mommy to not have pain. And the second wish, she said, I would like there to be no wars in the world and for everybody to be happy. And with the third wish, she had no idea what to do with. And I was just floored. I was just completely floored. I mean, I would, you know, she's 13 now. So she sort of discovered, you know, iPods and things. But but I'm sure, you know, it's a question of synthesis, and she will grow up, you know, into a different person. My father was just an incredible being. He was like a pillar of strength in my life, and the life of many, many, many people. He was a professor, and then he was a vice chancellor, but mostly he was just an incredible human being. And people came to him with all kinds of problems, and being a principal of a college in India meant you got to, you know, part of be the family counselor for a lot of people. So he helped a lot of people in many, many ways. And he was a great intellectual as well. But I just remember him as incredibly generous, happy, huge support, and just enjoyed life, enjoyed everything that came along. You know, just If I hear a new song, I miss my father because I can't share it with him. You know, I know you would have liked it. So gave a lot of joy to me, sort of, you know, taught me how to enjoy life. Apparently the story goes, and he was 13 or 14, he still had a huge temper. He had a big temper. And one day he realized that that was not good. And he decided that he would not have a huge temper anymore, and he didn't. And I find that incredible, given my own struggle with anger. And truly, I don't remember him hardly ever getting angry, once or twice, and he had reason to. But he still had a big ego, he had a huge ego. And we knew it. In spite of being this kind, generous person, he had a big ego. He knew exactly how good he was, you know. And he didn't really trouble anybody with his ego, but he had a big ego. And my mother says, he was a professor of political science, but later years he turned to teach Gandhi and Gandhian philosophy and Gandhi's life. And my mother said every year that he taught a course on Gandhi, he changed. And his ego became less and less and less until it vanished. And then, of course, with the cancer, knowing that he was going to pass away, I mean, that was just an incredible softening and beautifying of an absolutely beautiful man already. And I got to see that. And my mother, you know, as I said, I brought her here to do loving kindness practice or whatever. It wasn't quite for her, but I was in a lot of pain. And I had already learned to do Reiki, you know, which is kind of like a healing, faith, similar to faith healing, energy healing, call it what you will. And my mother did that and decided to give me Reiki, sort of do meditation, sort of like prayer, you know, sit in a chair. And because I wasn't always available to sort of put hands on me, or because I was busy, every day she would sit in that particular chair, you know, with her hands there and think of me well and give me Reiki for 20 minutes. And I saw my mother changed. Every month my mother changed. To bring that attention, that intention for somebody else's well-being completely, you know, for 25 minutes a day, that changed my mother. My grandmother was quite a dynamic woman, my mother's mother. And sometime later in her life, she decided she would not speak ill of anyone. You know, she said, I just don't want to. If I want to speak nice things, I will not speak ill of anyone. And that changed her. Because if you can't speak ill of anyone, what's the point of thinking ill of anyone? And slowly, you know, that changes. So realizing that you just have to live your mind, you know, live your life mindfully. And you really have the intention of living your life beautifully, and you really can go quite far with that. But also knowing that, you know, with help of a practice, help of a place coming there, and then something that happens that is completely out of your control, like that grace that happened, and there are other things like that happen. You can sort of go intensified, especially for a person like me who can't just will that, you know, I will stop being angry, or I'll start being such and such. I need that grace that I also get with this practice. And also the reminders to actually do the practice, why it's called practice. Just because, you know, I had that experience of grace does not mean that I don't have arguments with my husband, that I do not later on regret and say, what was the point of it? I have had experience where I felt as if I put my hand in the socket of the pain of the world. This happened last retreat here. Truly, I just felt personally connected to immense pain of this world, very personally. And there is a lot of pain in this world. But that's not enough. It's not been enough for me to behave in a way that I don't cause harm. I still have to bring that intention in every day. And I have to read the books, and I read suttas now. I used to read, you know, books, inspirational books, and come here Monday nights and sit at home as often as I can and try to hang out and try to see the beauty that is around me, whether in my mother or in my child or my husband or whoever, to be able to continue to do this. I thank you all so much for taking the time to listen to me. Let's just do a quick formal dedication. Just take an upright position, just where you are. Close your eyes. May any merit that our practice may have brought us today, may we share it with all beings everywhere. May all beings everywhere be well and happy and peaceful.